That's it exactly, Dr. Jamieson nodded. And yet Mr. Rhodes is concerned that we should not move ahead of them. There is one other thing that you should know, Heaney hesitated. It does seem that the gentlemen in Pretoria are aware that something is afoot. There is even talk that there is a traitor amongst us. That is unthinkable, snapped Zuga. I agree with you, Zuga, Dr. Jim nodded. It is much more likely that these damn puerile telegraphs of Frank Rhodes have come to old Kruger's notice. Be that as it may, gentlemen, the Boers are making certain preparations. It is even possible that they have already called out their commandos in the Rustenburg and Zierist divisions. If that is the case, Zuga said softly, then we have a choice. We can either move immediately, or we can all go home to Bulawayo. Dr. Jamieson could not remain seated any longer. He jumped up from his canvas chair and began pacing up and down the tent with quick, jerky little strides. They all watched in silence until he stopped in the opening of the tent and stared out across the sun-scorched plain towards the eastern horizon, beneath which lay the great golden prize of the Witwatersrand. When at last he turned to face them, they could see that he had reached his decision. "I am going," he said. "Thought you would," murmured Zuga. "What are you going to do?" Jamieson asked as softly. "Going with you," said Zuga. "Thought you would," said Jamieson, and then glanced at Willoughby, who nodded. "Good. Johnny, will you call the men out? I'd like to speak to them before we ride. And, Zuga, will you see to it that the telegraph lines are all cut? I don't want ever to see another one of those communications from Frankie. Anything more he has to say, he can tell me face to face when we reach Johannesburg." "They've got Jamieson!" The cry echoed through the elegant hush of the Kimberley Club, like a Hun war cry at the gates of Rome. The consternation was immediate and overwhelming. Members boiled out of the long bar into the marbled lobby and surrounded the news crier. Others from the reading room lined the banisters, shouting their queries down the stairwell. In the dining room, someone bumped into the carving wagon in his haste to reach the lobby, and sent it crashing on its side, while the joint rolled across the floor with roast potatoes preceding it like a squad of footmen. The bearer of the news was one of the prosperous Kimberley diamond buyers, a profession no longer referred to as copy-walloping, and such was his agitation that he had forgotten to remove his straw boater when entering the club portals, an offence that at another time would have merited a reprimand from the committee. Now he stood in the centre of the lobby, hat firmly on his head, and reading spectacles sliding to the end of his empurpled nose, a symptom of his excitement and agitation. He was reading from a copy of the Diamond Fields Advertiser, the ink of which was so fresh that it smeared his fingers. Quote, "Jamieson raises white flag at Doornkop after 16 killed in fierce fighting. Dr. Jamieson, I have the honour to meet you. General Cronier accepts surrender." Ralph Ballantyne had not left his seat at the head of the corner table, although his guests had deserted him to join the rush into the lobby. He signalled the distracted wine waiter to refill his glass, and then helped himself to another spoonful of the sole bonne femme, while he waited for his guests to return. They came trooping back, led by Aaron Fagan, like a funeral party returning from the cemetery. "The Boers must have been waiting for them. Dr. Jim walked straight into it. What on earth did the man think he was doing?" Chairs rasped, and every one of them reached for his glass the moment he was seated. "He had 660 men and guns. By God, it was a carefully planned thing, then." "There will be a few tales to tell. And heads to roll, no doubt. Dr. Jim's luck has run out at last. Ralph, your father is amongst the prisoners." Aaron was reading the newsprint. For the first time, Ralph showed emotion. "That's not possible." He snatched the paper from Aaron's hand and stared at it in agony. "What happened?" he muttered. "Oh, God, what has happened?" But somebody else was yelling in the lobby. "Kruger has arrested all the members of the Reform Committee. He has promised to have them tried for their lives." "The gold mines," another said clearly in the ensuing silence, and instinctively every head lifted to the clock on the wall above the dining-room entrance. It was 2:40. The stock exchange reopened on the hour. There was another rush, this time out of the club doors. On the sidewalk, hatless members shouted impatiently for their carriages, while others set out at a determined trot towards the stock exchange buildings. The club was almost deserted. Not more than 10 diners were left at the tables. Aaron and Ralph were alone at the corner table. Ralph still held the list of prisoners in his hand. "I cannot believe it," he whispered. "It is a catastrophe. What can possibly have possessed Jamieson?" Aaron agreed. It seemed that the worst had happened. Nothing could match the dreadful tidings that they had received so far. But then the club secretary came out of his office, ashen-faced, and stood in the doorway of the dining-room. "Gentlemen," he croaked, "I have some more terrible news. It has just come through on the wire. Mr. Rhodes has offered his resignation as Prime Minister of Cape Colony. He has also offered to resign from the chairmanship of the Charter Company, of De Beers, and of Consolidated Goldfields." "Rhodes," Aaron whispered. "Mr. Rhodes was in it. It's a conspiracy. The Lord only knows what will be the final consequences of this thing, and who Mr. Rhodes will bring down with him." "I think we should order a decanter of port," said Ralph, as he pushed his plate away from him. "I'm not hungry any more." He thought about his father in a Boer prison, and suddenly an image came into his mind of Zuga Ballantyne in a white shirt, his hands bound behind his back, his gold and silver laced beard sparkling in the sunlight, the whitewashed wall at his back, regarding the rank of riflemen in front of him with those calm green eyes of his. Ralph felt nauseated, and the rare old port tasted like quinine on his tongue. He set the glass down. "Ralph?" Aaron was staring at him across the table. "The Bear transaction. You sold the shares of Charter and Consolidated short, and your position is still open." "I have closed all your transactions," said David Silver. "I averaged out BSA shares at a little over £7. That gives you a profit after commission and levy of almost £4 a share. You did even better on the Consolidated Goldfields transactions. They were the worst hit in the crash. From £8 when you began selling them short, they dropped to almost £2 when it looked as though Kruger was going to seize the mining companies of the Witwatersrand in retaliation." David Silver broke off and looked at Ralph with awe. "It is the kind of killing which becomes a legend on the floor, Mr. Ballantyne. The frightful risk you took," he shook his head in admiration. "What courage! What foresight!" "What luck!" said Ralph impatiently. "Do you have my difference check?" "I have." David Silver opened the black leather valise on his lap and brought from it a snowy white envelope sealed with a rosette of scarlet wax. "It's countersigned and guaranteed by my bank." David laid it reverently upon his Uncle Aaron's desktop. "The total is," and he breathed it like a lover, £1,058.08. "After the one that Mr. Rhodes paid to Barney Bonato for his claims in the Kimberley mine, it is the largest cheque ever drawn in Africa, south of the equator. What do you say to that, Mr. Ballantyne?" Ralph looked at Aaron in the chair behind the desk. "You know what to do with it. Just be certain it can never be traced back to me." "I understand," Aaron nodded, and Ralph changed the subject. "Has there been an answer to my telegraph yet? My wife is not usually so slow in replying." And because Aaron was an old friend who loved the gentle Cathy as much as any of her many admirers, Ralph went on to explain. "She's within 2 months of her time. Now that the dust of Jamieson's little adventure has begun to settle and there's no longer any danger of war, I must get Cathy down here, where she can have expert medical attention." "I'll send my clerk to the telegraph office." Aaron rose and crossed to the door of the outer office to give his instructions. Then he looked back at his nephew. Was there anything else, David? The little stockbroker started. He had been staring at Ralph Ballantyne with the glow of hero worship in his eyes. Now he hastily assembled his papers and stuffed them into his valise before coming and offering his soft white hand to Ralph. I cannot tell you what an honour it has been to be associated with you, Mr. Ballantyne. If there is ever anything at all I can do for you... Aaron had to shoo him out of the door. Poor David, he murmured, as he came back to the desk. His very first millionaire. It's a watershed in any young stockbroker's life. My father, Ralph did not even smile. I'm sorry, Ralph, there is nothing more we can do. He will go back to England in chains with Jamieson and the others. They are to be imprisoned in Wormwood Scrubs until they are called to answer the charge. Aaron selected a sheet of paper from the pile on his desk. Quote, that they, with certain other persons, in the month of December 1895, in South Africa, within Her Majesty's dominions, did unlawfully prepare and fit out a military expedition to proceed against the dominions of a certain friendly state, to wit, the South African Republic, contrary to the provisions of the Foreign Enlistment Act of 1870. Aaron laid down the paper and shook his head. There is nothing any of us can do now. What will happen to them? It's a capital offence. Oh, no, Ralph, I'm sure it won't come to that. Ralph sank down in his chair and stared moodily out of the window, for the hundredth time castigating himself for not having anticipated that Jamieson would cut the telegraph lines before marching on Johannesburg. The recall that Cathy had sent to Zuga Ballantyne, the fiction that Louise was gravely ill, had never reached him, and Zuga had ridden into the waiting Boer commandos with the rest of them. If only, Ralph thought, and then his thoughts were interrupted. He looked up expectantly as the clerk came hesitatingly into the office. "Has there been a reply from my wife?" Ralph demanded, and the man shook his head. "Begging your pardon, Mr. Ballantyne, sir, but there is not," he hesitated, and Ralph urged him. "Well, man, what is it? Spit it out. There's a good fellow. It seems that all the telegraph lines to Rhodesia have been down since noon on Monday." "Oh, so that's it, is it?" "No, Mr. Ballantyne, that's not all. There's been a message from Tati on the Rhodesian border. It seems a rider got through this morning." The clerk gulped. "This messenger seems to have been the only survivor." "Survivor?" Ralph stared at him. "What does that mean? What on earth are you talking about?" "The Matabele have risen. They are murdering all the whites in Rhodesia, man, woman, and child. They are being slaughtered."
"Mummy! Douglas and Sus aren't here. There's nobody to get me breakfast."
John came into the tent while Cathy was still brushing out her hair and twisting it up into thick braids. "Did you call for them?"
"I called and called."
"Tell one of the grooms to go down and fetch them, darling."
"The grooms aren't here also."
"The grooms aren't here either," Cathy corrected him and stood up. "All right, then, let's go and see about your breakfast." Cathy stepped out into the dawn. Overhead, the sky was a lovely dark rose colour, shaded to ripe orange in the east, and the bird chorus in the trees above the camp was like the tinkle of silver bells. The campfire had died to a puddle of grey powdery ash, and had not been replenished. "Put some wood on, John," Cathy told him, and crossed to the kitchen hut. She frowned with annoyance. It was deserted. She took down a tin from the gauzed meat safe and then looked up as the doorway darkened.
"Oh, Isasi," she greeted the little Zulu. "Where are the other servants?"
"Who knows where Matabele dog will hide himself when he is needed?" Azazi asked this contemptuously.
"They have most likely spent the night dancing and drinking beer, and now their heads are too heavy to carry."
"You'll have to help me," said Cathy, "at least until the cook gets here." After breakfast in the dining tent, Cathy called Isasi from the fire again.
"Have any of them come back yet?"
"Not yet, Nkosikazi."
"I want to go down to the railhead. I hope there's a telegraph from Henshaw.
Will you put ponies into the trap, Isasi?
Then, for the first time, she noticed the little frown of concern on the old Zulu's wrinkled features.